Well, John, how long has it been since you've been in Alberta, moving from the Alberta Research Council over to the National Research Council in Ottawa?
It's just over 3 years, actually. I moved there in April of 2010.
And at the time, you could have easily retired, but you decided you were still going to take on this innovation push and the science and the research in Canada. What is it that attracted you to continue?
Well, it's true. I was actually going to, I'll never retire, but I was going to semi-retire. And that to me meant being able to really gain a lot more control over my own time. But I was asked if I would consider taking on the National Research Council. And, you know, having essentially decided to semi-retire, my immediate response was to say no. But the more I thought about it, actually, the more intrigued I became, because the National Research Council is, you know, probably, if you would put it in odd terms, but if you look at what there is to work with in Canada, it's probably the largest single entity that relates to research and innovation in the country. And if there's a place to have an impact, that's the place to have an impact.
Well, when you went to the National Research Council in 2010, what did you see? What's your analysis of the way things were at that time?
Well, the way it was working was essentially as a very researcher-driven kind of a place. The mandate of the National Research Council is really for economic development in Canada by working on issues that are of strategic importance to the country and to help grow the industries through technology. And what was happening was that the organization had become sort of a collection of entities, but wasn't really strategically managed, would be the best way to describe it. So there wasn't a lot of integration of the capabilities. There were facilities all over the country that kind of did their own thing. There were differences in terms of the business processes that were followed. There were differences in terms of the, let's say, the performance metrics that were considered, and so on. So it was really an organization that wasn't taking advantage of the critical mass that it could have and put together.
Some of those areas, I know that the National Research Council is behind NINT, the Nanotechnology Institute that's housed at the University of Alberta. What other big entities are there that it's involved in?
Well, we have facilities that really cover the spectrum from what's often called big science, so things like astronomy and physics and so on. And then the other extreme is the IRAP program, which works with these small and medium and often startup companies to help them with their technology. And then in between, there's a large capability which has people and really some terrific equipment that covers the gamut from aerospace to life sciences to electronics to data processing. You know, I mean, it's an amazing place. And these are spread all over the country.
So you made headlines this spring saying that you want to make some changes at the National Research Council. What changes do you want to make?
Well, fundamentally, what we wanted to do was make the organization much more strategic and, in a sense, return it to its original mandate. So if you actually read the Act, it would describe NRC in the terms, essentially, that I just spoke about, which were they don't quite use the term instrument of economic development, but if you read the Act, that's effectively what it is. They have other pieces which say that we should also operate the national observatories, so that puts us in the astronomy business. We should be the, in essence, the National Library for Science and Technology, so we're an information source. And so all of these things are there, but the question is, how do you put them together in a world where the value is increasingly multidisciplinary and whole system oriented? So we had to move the organization essentially from working on little pieces of things that were of interest to a researcher to things that were looked at in a more holistic way that would benefit Canada as a whole and help our economy grow and develop. So to do that, we said we weren't going to operate institutes anymore. What we were going to do is operate programs. And the difference is that an institute is people and bricks and mortar. A program is really a challenge or a critical issue or a problem that faces the country that we can bring resources together from wherever they happen to be to address it and try to deal with it.
So where does that leave institutes that are already in place, like NINT?
Well, NINT's a bit of a special case because NINT is actually not an NRC institute per se. It's an operation that brings together the university and NRC to try to bridge between sort of fundamental academic type research and more industry-oriented applied research. So in that sense, it connects to what we're trying to do, but it's, if you like, a special place where we're trying to really connect the whole together in a more tangible way. So you could think of it almost as an experiment in collaboration between the classic academic researcher and maybe the more mission-oriented and applied research community to connect to industry. So I wouldn't use NINT as the model or the example of what we're trying to do.
What would be an example then of the change coming?
Okay, a better example would be things like our program in biomaterials, where we had little bits of activity all over the country. So we had a materials institute in Quebec that was working on biomaterials. We had a place in Ontario that was working in biomaterials. We had a place in, even here, NINT to some degree was working on biomaterials. There were, and so on. So we had bits and pieces all over the place. What we've done is we've now created a program in biomaterials that brings the full capabilities of the organization together and applies them to particular issues that we've been able to identify. So in some cases, they're quite applied in aerospace and automotive applications. In other cases, they're more upstream because we're learning about how to actually develop biomass with particular kinds of characteristics and so on. So that brings in places like our genetics operations in Saskatoon and some of the ability to work at the nano level here in Alberta, you know, and so on. And so suddenly we now have programs that draw all of these people together. And we think about it not just from an ability to do, if you like, a scientific advance, but the ability to actually provide the whole, the science, the technology, and the, if you like, the manufacturability and integration into the whole system that would ultimately put it into auto or aerospace or other application.
So how do you keep track of all that?
Well, one thing you do is you don't do as many things, right? So what we essentially had before was probably 1,500 to 2,000 researchers essentially doing projects that they were interested in doing. We're now doing more like 50 programs, and you can manage 50 programs. You can't really manage 1,500 individuals individually, if I can put it that way.
So does it become driven top-down in terms of what you're going to choose for projects?
Yeah, it's both, actually. That's a very enlightened question. It becomes both top-down and bottom-up. So the first question is, what are the kind of things that really matter to Canada? And that becomes a top-down problem. And then the challenge to the researchers is, what could you do, what could you potentially contribute to helping us deal with that problem or issue or challenge? And they come together with essentially what you might think of as an investment proposal, which is looked at. We call them originally, or initially, we call them value propositions. So what we try to end up with is people who can say that, yes, we understand that this is a real issue and this is why it is an issue. And if we can do this for this amount of money over this kind of time frame, here's the benefit that would come from it. And then, of course, that's a very open process. It goes beyond our own people, actually. So the ideas can come from outside as well as inside. If there's something good to do, then our challenge is, how do we make sure it's successful?
And are you trying to encourage collaboration as well beyond the National Research Council?
Yeah, very, very much, actually, because even though we're a big organization, we're tiny when it comes to the issue of knowledge and technology, right? There's all kinds of stuff happening in all over Canada, but even more all around the world. So collaboration becomes very, very important. There's no point in doing something that's already been done, for example. We should just figure out how to get our hands on it. We don't have all the skills, so if there are skills that we need, we should be finding ways to find them and work with them. Our sweet spot, if you like, is the space in between fundamental research and the more day-to-day problem stuff that industry will work with, which is really where this, if you like, the strategic sweet spot is.
One of the criticisms that has resulted from this is that some people are saying, well, if we focus too much on commercialization, then we're not focusing on basic science, and basic science is going to the wayside. What's your answer to that criticism?
Well, the way you pose the question is in many ways the answer. It's a question of too much. It's really a question of balance, right? There's no question that if you want to be a player in the world, you've got to be a player in fundamental and basic research. So if you want to be a leader, you have to have that. But that by itself won't make you a leader in innovation. And we've proven that, I think, pretty well in Canada by the fact that as we've ramped up spending in the fundamental and curiosity and researcher-driven side, our innovative and competitive performance relative to others in the world has steadily declined. So while the big wins, you know, the big game changers, if you like, are the disruptive technologies that everybody talks about, they're very few in number, and so we can't rely on them only. We want them, right? Nobody would be suggesting that we don't want those things. But most of what happens is not enormous breakthroughs. Most of it is incremental and evolutionary, and it's applying what we already know to problems. So the issue becomes one more of being able to define problems that matter and do things where Canada has some potential to actually capture the benefits. One of the other challenges that we find is, and NRC was certainly in this space, we did lots of work with lots of international players, but in essence what we were doing is we were simply giving them our knowledge, right? And Canada wasn't the beneficiary of it. So that's not to suggest you don't want to play globally, because you do. But ultimately, you've got to do things that your own economy can benefit from as well, or you can't continue to do them.
So what might be those areas then that are important to Canada that you see the National Research Council playing a role?
Well, initially, we went and took a hard look at everything we could find all over the world in terms of scenarios and studies and thoughts about the future and where the world was going. And in essence, we looked for the things that were common to all, regardless what kind of a world was going to emerge, whether it was based on a low-carbon world or an environmentally sensitive world or a terrorism-driven world or a trade-restricted or open-trade world or, you know, whatever. So we looked at all of these kind of things. And then we looked at them through a lens from a Canadian perspective and said, what are the elements of those things that are common to all that particularly apply to Canada? And we found, and this won't be surprising, we found six major areas that really resonated, that are going to be there kind of no matter what, and where Canada has a particular interest. One of them, surprise, surprise, was resources. And that comes out simply because we have such a large geographic footprint, we have a disproportionate and a small population, so we have a disproportionate amount of the world's resources. And that's not going to go away or change. So the likelihood is resources will continue to be important one way or another for Canada, whether it's minerals and energy or water or biomass or whatever. But with that comes environment, because when you're producing resources, you have environmental issues you have to deal with. And then we have the added issue in Canada of being highly urbanized, so we have an extra environmental challenge that's simply results from our urban concentration. So that was the second area. Third one that emerged was health, but health cost. Not health technology, but actually how can we contain health costs and still provide good service. Fourth one was security. Again, the scale of the country makes things like sovereignty and infrastructure security and so on very important, but also security from a more classic defense and other kind of mindset. The whole infrastructure that knits our communities together was important, so that's, you know, our water and sewer and communications and roads and transportation systems, communication systems, etc. And then finally, we have a sort of an existing value-adding economy, which is essentially the manufacturing side of our activities, and how do we sustain and grow that, if at all possible. So those were the six areas. As I say, not really hugely surprising when you think about it, but in a sense, reassuring that those kind of fell out of some fairly thorough look-sees of what's going on around the world. And then we've challenged people to go after those with things that could help address those areas.
One of the things that I know is dear to your heart is the algae biomass and where that might go. And I know that when I first spoke to you in 2001, you said that it was clear to you that biotechnology and informatics were emerging as key areas that we should be focusing on. And then again in 2008, you said you were talking about algae, and you referred to it as being the poster child for the way that we have to start thinking about how we do research and the kinds of things we're looking at. Now I see that in October of this year in Florida, they're having a global algae biomass conference. So tell us, what is happening with algae and why is it so important?
Well, I think you back up a little bit to the beginning of the thought process, which you referred to, and that was that when you look at the world and the way we've acted versus the way the world itself has naturally behaved, the natural process is one that never has a start or an end, really. It just constantly takes the, you know, the waste or the emissions or the whatever from one process and it feeds it into another process and it just goes round and round and round. And I think when we have these massive populations, what it means is we have to start ourselves thinking in those ways with the things that we do. And whether it's CO2 or really anything else, we've got to be finding ways to, I think, mimic nature more. And because Alberta, you could see, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, you could see these growing challenges of things like emissions that maybe in early days were thought to be benign, like CO2. Today we're not so sure, obviously. But it just says, you know, you've got to think about, if you've got an emission, you should be thinking about what does it go into? What does it become? How do we turn it into something that is, in fact, constructively valuable? And that led to the fact that, well, in Canada certainly, and in Alberta even more so, we've got an enormous resource of CO2 being produced that isn't being used. It's being thrown away. And when you throw anything away long enough, it piles up and becomes visible, whether it's visible in the sense of a dump, or whether it's in the visible in terms of a concentration in the atmosphere or whatever it may be, but it becomes apparent after a while. So you got to do something with it. So that led us to say, well, what's the way that nature deals with CO2? And if you went way back in time, algae is what turned the world into a world that allowed people like us to live on it by reducing the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere some billion or 2 years ago. So why don't we mimic that? And that leads to the idea of, well, and what would you mimic it with? Maybe algae, maybe something else, but algae is the best that we found up to this point in time anyway. And we began to think about, well, could we connect that on, if you like, to the exhaust stacks and emission stacks of some of these major producers of CO2? And it's come a ways, and now we have a demonstration project under construction with CNRL and some other partners. And the world, of course, is looking at algae as potentially sources of valuable product. So we can connect a lot of that kind of work onto what we're doing. We're focusing primarily on our ability to capture and convert CO2. Others have focused more on the ability to convert algae. So you put the two together, we can get some pretty powerful things potentially.
Well, considering that other people around the world are also looking to algae, how do you position yourself globally?
I maybe didn't explain it very clearly, but I was saying our focus is on making algae, if I could put it that way. Others have been focused predominantly on how to convert algae into other things. So it actually fits together quite well. And we're plugged in with much of the world events. So you mentioned one in Florida. There's also a major biomarine conference that's going on in Halifax in September that we'll be talking about it. We have partners in France. We're talking to partners in Israel, et cetera, on our piece of the game as well. So there's no question that what we were talking about, you know, 10 years ago is starting to really resonate now.
It seems kind of funny that on the one hand, we're draining wetlands and getting rid of the places where algae is formed to build plants to make and control algae to make things better.
Well, it is in a way. It's you can always find those sort of, I'm not sure what you would call it, but yes, funny is, you know, sort of ironic in a way.
So beyond algae, when you look at what's happening in Canada, the Conference Board came out with a report not too long ago, and it was just one of several that have really kind of said we're not carrying our weight in terms of innovation and productivity. What's your take, or what's your perspective on that?
Well, I think that I would agree to a large degree that Canada, for whatever reason, has struggled with innovation, right? There's no question about it. And I think every report that's come out over the past decade, just about, has reinforced that point. They all confirm that, you know, we need new approaches to change our innovation performance because it isn't happening. You know, you can speculate on the reasons. My personal speculation is that it is about balance and that, you know, we've got to do more than knowledge generation. We actually have to be in the conversion world too. But if all of our efforts are driven from what you might think of as the push side, then what happens is that you don't take into account enough the demand from the user. And the user ultimately determines what happens, if I can put it that way. And for a user to change what they do, you have to have a pretty good understanding of their market and of their customers and of the whole system that they operate that includes manufacturing and distribution and, you know, just everything. Because if they're going to change to a different approach, different technology, different manufacturing methods, different whatever, they kind of have to tear up their old system and build a new one, right? That's very risky. And as a result of that, it takes a really huge advance before they'll do that. Now, if it's a piece of software, that may be relatively easy because it doesn't have the same fixed capital investment associated with it, if I could maybe put it in those terms. It's very hard to convince yourself to tear down your existing house to build a new one. Very few people do that. They move somewhere else. They sell what they've got. They may buy a new house. But very few of them tear down their old one and start over. And in the innovation world, it's exactly the same. It's the last thing you want to do because intrinsically you feel like you're throwing away value. And that's one of the reasons why the disruptive innovations typically don't occur in existing enterprises. So again, when they happen, they're big. But most innovation, well over 90%, is occurring in existing enterprises. And so it means you really have to understand them if you're going to make a significant gain within your existing economy. If you were starting over, it would be a different thing, right? But you have an existing economy, and you can't just throw it all away and say, I'm going to start over.
It's almost like there's two things working against each other, because on the one hand, you do need to be able to take risks, in a sense, like the risk of tearing down your house or your economy and starting all over, but also managing that risk so that you're not throwing things away. So what supports are there to kind of help move things forward so that we're not constantly stuck in that, in that rut?
Well, this is the challenge, is if you try to make it, say, a black and white choice, because it isn't a black and white choice, right? It's very specific to the application. So, for example, let's start with the interesting disruptive things, you know, like the digital camera, right? First developed by Kodak. Okay, never developed because they had a nice film business, they had a conventional camera business, they had all that stuff, they knew how to do it. They couldn't get themselves excited about destroying their own business, but their business ultimately got destroyed. So there's an element there that you have to be conscious of. That's the sort of story that is told regularly in the disruptive space, right? Disruptions in industries don't happen frequently. Even in the world of IT, you know, if you think about it, much of what we use isn't, how would I describe this? It's enhancing things as opposed to fundamentally changing them. So yes, we've got an app, so we can now do something on our phone that we used to do on our computer. But fundamentally, we've gotten convenience out of the system by adding incremental value to it, right? It's not truly disruptive technology. Disruption was the internet, maybe in retailing. So we're seeing that play out. But most of the apps and the, you know, the LinkedIn replacing phone books, et cetera, are, in essence, they're new ways of doing the same things. But the fundamental shift in science that's driving them all was made a long time ago. So this, in many ways, I don't mean to demean this stuff, but in many ways, if you think about Sony, who used to put out, you know, I don't know how many different product lines of everything, it wasn't that they were really different, it was just that they packaged them a little bit differently. And in the consumer space, one of the challenges that we have is that the consumer space is an emotional buy to a large degree, or it certainly has a significant emotional context to it. The industrial space is not an emotional buy, right? And so you have to differentiate between those two, too. Canada is primarily an industrial place as opposed to a consumer product place in terms of what we produce and make and so on. So that means that Canada has to be thinking less emotionally and much more about specifications and costs and things like that, because industry rarely buys on emotion. Now, if we were in a different world, if we were producing consumer products and so on, and we do some, in fairness, then you have to think about it from a different perspective. And our challenge always is to make sure that we understand what we're looking at. All the different sectors are different. You know, biotech is different than aerospace, is different than IT, and yet they all come together in some ways. And when you're trying to blend them together, you get some very interesting challenges to deal with. So all of this, I mean, what I'm not probably explaining anything, but I'm trying to give you a sense of the complexity of the challenge that one has to deal with. And that's why you have to get very focused on the particular area that you're working in and make sure you really understand it and don't try to imagine that you can apply the same process that you might in another area, because it well may be completely wrong.
What have you taken then from your experience leading the Alberta Research Council to what you're doing now with the National Research Council?
A few things. Some of the things that we did with the Alberta Research Council that I think were very enlightening were learning to work with the user community. And what you find, and this is, I would say, very broadly based, it's not limited to anywhere particularly, but Canada as a whole in our science and research community is not very market-oriented. We sort of pretend that we are, if I can put it that way. So we talk about applications in the grandest sense, but they're not precise enough to really do much with. And let me give you an example. Sensors and controls is an amazing area today because you can measure just about anything, and with IT you can then build models and algorithms, and then you can kind of control things. And in fact, you can go beyond that to the point where your systems actually learn while they operate and adapt themselves, right? So it's a very interesting area. What I've found is that most researchers tend to describe, when they're thinking about or trying to promote a particular agenda, will promote, let's say, the entire world market for sensors, right? So they'll talk about the $3 trillion market or something for sensors, when what they're actually producing is something that would be applicable to a particular kind of production facility, which might need one or two of them each, and there might be 100 or 200 of these facilities around the world, and even if the sensors cost $100,000 each, right, it's still only maybe a $10 or $20 million market. But they talk about it as this $1 trillion or $2 trillion market. Mint was launched the same way, actually. At the time it was launched, they were talking about the $1.5 trillion market in nanotechnology, and therefore this thing is just going to explode and take off. But what people forget is that the ability to do something scientifically usually then requires or is enabled by tools that can work in that area. So the first thing you do when you're learning about new science is you actually develop tools that allow you to work with it. Out of that, then may ultimately come technology that allow you to actually do something on a repetitive basis that's reasonably predictable. And then you've got to find a place to apply it. And then you've got to put all the other system components around it. And then you have to convince somebody that it's good enough to replace what they already do and will generate enough value that they're prepared to take the risk of doing so. And we tend to be stuck in the very early stage of saying, this science could lead to this. Yes, it could, but science doesn't. Let me put it this way. If you allow science to take you down a constantly diverging path, you never get closure. So you've got to be thinking always about how you're bringing it to some kind of convergence that is specific to a system and specific to an application. And that's why balance becomes important. I don't expect a basic researcher to do that. But if I'm going to ever find ways to use it effectively in the marketplace, I need people who can.
What benchmarks have you set for yourself then so that you know if you've made it or not in terms of this new direction?
Well, we will find as we go along, and we are finding, actually. Our first benchmark was really whether we could get clients, right? Can we get people, or partners, partners is clients and partners is the better way to describe it, who would actually say, yes, we see that as important enough that we're prepared to invest too. So co-investment becomes very important. Our view is that if you can't find a co-investor, it's at a very early stage, which means either that it still is really in the fundamental research stage, or the timeline is so long that the risk is so high that co-investors tell you that, in effect, they turn that around, right? They tell you, yes, we think we can do this in a timely way, and yes, we think we can do it in a way that would add value. So that's number one. Number two will be as the technologies emerge, that they actually do put them to work, that they invest in their application. So again, a good example, going back to algae, which we talked about, is the fact that we have partners like CNRL who are prepared to invest. We have financial people who are prepared to invest. We have other technology developers who are coming to the table and are willing to collaborate together to try to deliver. But ultimately, the true test is the outcomes that emerge from it, which is the fact that problem is dealt with, it leads to cost reductions or additional sales or new employment or new exports. You know, it's the fact that we actually create economic value from it. And so as we go along, we have milestones along the way so that we know we're reasonably likely to get there. And if we start to get too far away from them, then we know we got serious problems that we either have to fix or shut it down and try something else.
Thank you very much, John.
You're very welcome, Cheryl. Good to talk to you.